We all do it, right? Say things like, I'm happy or I'm sad.
Yeah, these simple labels.
But they cover such huge, complex internal landscapes. What if our emotional lives are actually much richer, much more specific?
Oh, they absolutely are. Infinitely more nuanced than those everyday words suggest. And really diving into that nuance can be incredibly insightful.
How so?
Well, it just opens up new ways of understanding ourselves.
Yeah.
And understanding other people, too.
Absolutely. So today we're doing just that. We're taking a deep dive into something called a hierarchical feelings word field.
Sounds technical, but it's actually quite practical.
Exactly. Think of it like a map, maybe, an emotional GPS to help navigate this, you know, intricate landscape of human feelings with more precision.
And our source for this exploration is a really well-structured document. It's titled Feelings Word Field Descriptions. And it comes from Turtle Coaching.
Yeah, it gives this brilliant two-level breakdown of emotions. It takes us from the real basics, the fundamentals, all the way to the subtle shifts in intensities.
It's a great framework.
So our mission for you, the listener, is pretty clear. By the end of this, you should have a more nuanced vocabulary for your own feelings.
And hopefully a deeper understanding of what others might be experiencing too.
It's all about getting that knowledge quickly, but really thoroughly, aiming for those, you know, aha moments.
Those moments of clarity, yeah.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Level one of this word field, the core emotions.
The foundations.
Right. These are presented as the fundamental building blocks. Everything else sort of emerges from these.
And it's powerful, this kind of framework, because it helps us move beyond just labeling. It pushes us to genuinely grasp not just what an emotion is, but often why it's showing up. It's a critical lens for self-awareness and for empathy, too.
Definitely. So let's explore these foundations. The source lists 10 core emotions.
They're big ones.
They are. Joy, sadness, anger, fear, surprise, disgust, affection, contempt, curiosity, and shame.
Like the primary colors on an emotional palette, you could say.
That's a good way to put it. Let's start with joy. How does the source describe joy?
It's described as a deeply felt positive emotion. Contentment. Happiness. He often kind of radiates outwards.
You see it as laughter, maybe an inner lightness, almost like a glow.
Exactly. And it's usually triggered by positive things, successes, good experiences, pleasant encounters. Seems pretty universal.
It does.
And one powerful point here is that joy isn't just passive. It's described as an energy that radiates.
Right.
So the insight is, if you actively seek out or reflect on those positive triggers, you can actually amplify joy in your life. Moving from just contentment to active well-being.
Okay, so moving to the other end of the spectrum then, we have sadness.
The painful one.
Described as a painful emotion, often following loss or disappointment.
Yeah, and it can show up as crying, maybe feeling despondent, wanting to withdraw.
Or just an inner emptiness. But the source highlights it as an important process for coping with loss.
And that underscores something crucial. Even painful emotions like sadness have a function.
Yeah.
They're adaptive.
Not just something to avoid.
Right. It's presented as a necessary process. It helps us process difficult things, and ultimately, it helps us heal.
Okay. Next up is anger.
An intense one.
Described as intense, often passionate, arising from perceived injustice, maybe a threat or frustration.
And its manifestations can vary a lot, from simple irritation
to wrath, even aggression, or sometimes just a powerful desire for change.
That's a key point, actually. Looking at definitions like this shows anger isn't always destructive.
How so?
Well, if it's rooted in injustice, it can become a catalyst for positive change. It drives us to address wrongs, not just react impulsively.
That makes sense. Then there's fear.
The protective one.
A fundamental protective emotion. It pops up in response to danger, whether it's real or just imagined.
It acts like a shield, really. Manifesting as nervousness, maybe panic, anxiety.
Or that undeniable urge to just get away, flee.
Such a primal response, isn't it?
Mm.
The source really emphasizes that its core purpose is protection. It doesn't matter if the threat is real and right there, or just a shadow in your mind.
Surprise is an interesting one next.
Yes. The fleeting one.
Described as fleeting, intense reaction to something unexpected. An event. Some information.
Could be positive, could be negative. Often shown through, like, wide eyes, or just a moment of pause, being stunned.
That's a sudden jolt.
And the source reveals how transient it really is. It's just that momentary disruption, a quick reset of our expectations.
Before other emotions kick in.
Exactly. Like joy, or fear, or maybe just confusion.
Okay. Our next core emotion is disgust.
Ooh, strong one.
A strong aversion, revulsion towards something seen as unpleasant, maybe dirty, spoiled.
Or even morally repugnant. And the source explicitly says it serves as protection against contamination.
So an evolutionary purpose.
Definitely. It's a fundamental alarm system. Protecting us from spoiled food, sure, but also from actions that violate our moral code.
Then we have affection.
A much warmer one.
A warm, positive feeling.
Yeah.
Liking, goodwill, closeness towards a person, an animal, maybe even an object sometimes.
And it's presented as the basis for deeper relationships. Friendship, love.
So it's foundational.
Essentially, yeah. The glue that binds us. Forming the bedrock of meaningful connections, human or even with animals. It's a core social emotion.
Now, on the flip side of connection, there's contempt.
The dismissive one.
A feeling of deep disdain, disregard toward someone or something perceived as inferior, unworthy, maybe repellent.
And it can manifest as arrogance or just outright rejection.
Yeah.
It's striking how contempt isn't just internal. It often involves dismissing or devaluing the other person, positioning oneself as superior.
That makes it particularly corrosive in relationships, doesn't it?
And very much so.
Curiosity is next. This feels crucial for growth.
Absolutely. The driving force.
Described as the urge to discover, to learn, understand new things, it pushes us to ask questions, explore, engage.
And the source highlights it as crucial for personal growth.
It makes you think, doesn't it? How much of our development, intellectual and personal, is just powered by this innate urge to explore?
It's presented almost as a key driver of human progress itself.
And finally, for our core emotions, we have shame.
A painful one.
Described as a painful feeling of humiliation, exposure, comes up when you believe you failed to meet expectations or moral standards, maybe made a mistake.
And it often leads to withdrawal, wanting to hide.
Yeah.
This really highlights shame as intensely internal, often isolating. It's deeply tied to our sense of self-worth and how we think society sees us. Makes it very difficult to navigate.
Okay, so we've laid out our 10 core emotions, the foundation.
The building blocks.
But here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Where this word field becomes such a valuable tool. Level 2.
The nuances.
Exactly. Level 2 expands on these core emotions. It offers this incredibly granular vocabulary for all the subtle variations, the different intensities, the specific contexts.
This is where we get to the heart of understanding what someone really means when they describe how they feel, moving beyond the broad strokes.
Yes. This transition to level 2 is vital. It takes us from those broad categories to the precise shades of emotion.
Allowing for a far more accurate and empathetic emotional vocabulary. It's about grasping the subtle differences between feelings, even if they share the same root.
Let's take joy as an example. Let's see its many facets. Beyond just general happiness, you know, that deep, lasting well-being, we have more energetic forms. Like enthusiasm, the source calls it lively, zealous joy.
And exuberance, that unrestrained, carefree delight. You just feel it bubbling up.
It shows joy isn't a monolith, does it?
Not at all. It covers everything from quiet, lasting contentment.
Which the source defines as inner peace from meeting expectations.
All the way to almost overwhelming sensations like euphoria, which is described as excessively strong, maybe even with a loss of reality.
Wow, so a huge range.
A vast internal landscape just within joy.
And there's enjoyment too, the conscious appreciation of pleasant sensory experiences.
Yeah, and the source also details others like cheerfulness, bliss, well-being, pleasure, all painting this rich spectrum.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? For you listening, what specific flavor of joy might you be feeling right now? It's probably more specific than just happy.
Good question.
Okay, moving on to the nuances of sadness. This one has a fascinating point in the source about melancholy.
Ah, yes. It uses the term in two distinct ways.
Right. On one hand, it's that mild, wistful sadness. Kind of poetic, maybe? The mood on a gray afternoon, perhaps?
That sort of gentle, thoughtful sadness.
But crucially, the source also uses melancholy to describe something else.
Yes, a more prolonged, depressed mood. Characterized by hopelessness, passivity, almost like a mild depression.
So the distinction often lies in the intensity and duration.
Exactly. Yeah. Is it fleeting wistfulness or a persistent heavy state? Understanding the dual meaning gives us valuable precision.
Then we have grief, defined as a painful feeling of sorrow and worry, often from personal problems or loss.
Which is distinct from despair. Despair is described as extreme hopelessness, seeing absolutely no way out.
A very dark place.
Indeed. And then there's longing. That gentle, almost nostalgic sadness for something unattainable, a mix of wistfulness and yearning.
That's a beautiful description.
Longing especially shows how sadness can blend with other feelings like yearning, creating a unique emotional mix. It's different from raw grief, a powerful nuance for expressing yourself.
We also see sorrow, deep, persistent sadness burdening the mind, and suffering.
Described as a comprehensive, painful burden, physical or psychological.
The source also notes anguish, desolation, and dejection as further variations. Each carries its own specific emotional weight. It's quite detailed.
Very detailed.
Now let's explore the shades of anger. Think about annoyance.
The mild end of the scale.
Yeah, that moderate irritation. Maybe your internet is slow or someone's tapping their pen.
But then there's irritability.
Yeah.
Which isn't just about a specific trigger, is it?
No, the source presents it more as a heightened state. You're already on edge, and small things feel like major insults.
It's interesting how anger escalates in intensity in these descriptions, from that mild annoyance.
We can move to wrath, defined as stronger, more intense anger, often linked with outrage, or even a desire for revenge.
Right. And then there's resentment.
Ah, the slow burn.
Exactly. Persistent, deep-seated hostility, usually from a past injustice you can't let go of.
And outrage is specifically described as morally motivated anger.
Triggered by perceived injustice or disregard for deeply held values.
Yeah. And frustration comes up when your goals are blocked, leading to that mix of anger and disappointment.
Outrage is particularly interesting because it roots anger, injustice, and morality. It separates it from more personal anger.
Helping us see how anger can sometimes be a force for advocating for what's right.
Precisely. The source also details hatred, temper tantrums, fury, and rage, really showcasing the full spectrum of intensity, from mild irritation to losing control.
Okay, time to delve into the nuances of fear. Let's start with dread.
That specific feeling.
Yeah, described as a specific reaction to an identifiable, often looming threat. It feels more targeted than general fear, like dreading a difficult conversation you know is coming.
And what's powerful here is how fear manifests physically. Think of panic.
Sudden, overwhelming fear.
Often with a loss of control. And those physiological symptoms, racing heart, shortness of breath, it highlights that deep mind-body connection.
Definitely. And apprehension.
Described as an oppressive, often physically palpable worry, like a tightness in your chest before a big presentation.
Whereas worry is more mental.
Yes, a state of concern about possible future negative events, often that looping thought pattern.
And unease is milder still, a restless discomfort, maybe without a clear cause.
It's fascinating how fear can show up in these subtle internal ways before it potentially escalates. This breakdown helps us spot those early signs.
The source also highlights terror, stage fright, phobia, horror, and anxiety, each painting a really distinct picture of fear.
A whole landscape of fear.
Now for surprise, beyond that initial jolt, what else is there?
Well, there's wonder.
Described as astonishment plus curiosity, you're left pondering something unexpected and remarkable.
And amazement takes that wonder up a level, often leaving you speechless because it's so intense.
It's interesting how wonder and amazement layer those positive feelings, curiosity, awe, onto the initial surprise, shows its potential for positive experiences.
Almost a sense of the sublime sometimes.
And astonishment mixes surprise with admiration. It's not just unexpected, it's impressive.
On the other hand, perplexities, confusion, bewilderment, because it's something unexpected. You just don't get it.
This source also notes ignorance, catching off guard, speechlessness, dumbfoundedness, which is described as awe, often positive.
Breathlessness and just the quality of unexpectedness itself, all facets of how we react to the unknown.
Let's move to the subcategories of disgust, starting with revulsion.
Deep, intense aversion. Often with a moral rejection component.
Right. It's not just, I don't like this food. It can be, I find this act morally repugnant.
That really shows how revulsion goes beyond just sensory dislike. It connects to our values, our ethics, an internal alarm for things that violate our principles.
And aversion is described as a more general reluctance or dislike.
Then there's nausea, which can be physical or psychological disgust. Feeling sick to your stomach.
And sickness itself, that unpleasant stomach feeling, urge to vomit, intensified by the disgust.
Makes you think how much of our perception of unpleasant or repugnant is rooted in this basic protective mechanism.
A primal filter.
For what we allow into our system, physically and sometimes mentally too. The source also details dislike, shudder, gag reflex, repulsion, abhorrence, and displeasure, each a unique flavor of aversion.
Now, for the many layers of affection, let's start with love.
the big one. Defined as deep, intense affection, devotion, goodwill. Goes beyond simple liking. Often implies commitment.
And tenderness.
Those gentle, loving gestures or sensations expressing care, maybe through touch or soft words.
It reminds us that love, as described here, isn't just a feeling, but an active, outward state of devotion and care.
Yeah, it's about building and nurturing connection.
And connection itself is defined as that feeling of close belonging, deep understanding with another person.
Then warmth, that friendly, open manner that makes others feel welcome.
And crucially, empathy.
The ability to understand and genuinely share the feelings of others, stepping into their emotional shoes.
Empathy really highlights how affection is tied to cognitive understanding, bridging those emotional gaps.
Absolutely. The source also lists comfort, kindness, care, sympathy, and attachment, all enriching this idea of affection.
Okay, let's look at the subcategories of contempt. Disregard is first.
Feeling something or someone is unimportant. Worthless.
And scorn.
A mocking, derogatory remark, or just rejecting someone out of pride or contempt, often verbal.
It's striking again how contempt often manifests externally, in dismissive actions, words.
It really shows up in how we treat others, yeah.
Mockery is described as humor aimed at ridiculing someone, often with that undercurrent of contempt.
And disrespect is a conscious ignoring, a deliberate signal you don't value someone.
Our source also lists disdain, a lack of respect shown through impolite behavior.
This brings up that tricky line between humor and mockery, doesn't it? When does teasing cross into contempt?
These distinctions give us language for that. The source also highlights aversion as a form of contempt sometimes. Condescension and condemnation, always we devalue or reject.
It's a complex area.
Next, the intricacies of curiosity. Observation is listed.
Attentive viewing out of interest. Watching details closely, like observing a bird.
And questioning is that critical examination for deeper understanding, a direct expression of wanting to know more.
What's powerful here is how curiosity immediately leads to action. We don't just feel curious, we do something, observe, question.
It's inherently active.
Very much so. And learning is defined as acquiring knowledge, motivated by that interest.
While research is the systematic investigation driven by deep curiosity,
the source also notes exploration, the concrete act of discovering and investigating.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, curiosity is basically presented as the engine of intellectual growth and discovery.
The driving force behind so much advancement, personal and societal. The source further lists concentration, attention, understanding, immersion, and investigation as active facets.
Finally, we arrive at the nuances related to shame, often showing up as embarrassment. First is blushing.
That involuntary reddening of the face, a physical giveaway of embarrassment or shame, you can't control it.
And stuttering can be a speech reaction to strong embarrassment, that nervous breakdown of fluency.
It's powerful how immediate and involuntary some of these physical signs are. Our bodies betray our internal discomfort.
And withdrawal is a common reaction, removing yourself from an uncomfortable situation.
Similarly, avoidance, circumventing situations that might cause embarrassment, like skipping the public speaking gig.
Makes you wonder how much of our social behavior, consciously or not, is shaped by wanting to avoid embarrassment.
It's striking how many of these are about managing that social discomfort.
Apologizing is listed, expressing regret for misconduct, often to ease embarrassment.
You're looking away, averting your gaze to avoid eye contact. A quick escape.
Self-minimization is interesting. Downplaying yourself, making yourself seem smaller, often out of embarrassment or shame.
The source also details self-doubt, shyness, and awkwardness as further nuances here. Feelings of discomfort, insecurity.
Wow. What a journey that was. We've just unpacked this huge spectrum of human emotions.
Moving way beyond just happy or sad.
From those fundamental core emotions to their countless nuances, intensities, we've really started to appreciate the rich detail, the specific sensations of our inner world.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And this isn't just about collecting words, is it? It's about connecting those words to actual lived experiences.
Right.
Having this expanded emotional vocabulary can profoundly enhance your self-awareness.
Yeah.
It helps you articulate your own feelings with much greater precision.
And not just your own, it improves communication with others too, helping you understand what someone really means when they say they feel melancholy versus despair, for example.
Exactly. And that fosters deeper empathy because you're better equipped to interpret the emotional states of people around you.
It's about being truly well-informed, not just about external facts, but about these crucial internal realities.
So as you reflect on this deep dive, really consider the power of precision in emotional language.
Think about it. The next time you find yourself just saying, I'm fine, or I'm okay.
How might understanding these specific nuances change the way you actually describe your feelings to someone else?
Or how you interpret what they might be feeling when they use certain words?
Consider the conversations that might open up.
Or the misunderstandings that could be avoided. What small shift in vocabulary could change things for you? Something to ponder.